This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. Now we're going to find out whether or not I have the magic combination to keep Android Auto from kicking off. Oh, maybe. Okay. All right, cool. Yay. I just have to remember that for next week. So, anyways, all is well. My beloved, who broke her shoulder 2 weeks ago now, is doing okay. She's doing okay. She's getting used to things, but it's coming along. She's learning what she can do and what she can't do, and she's learning it, and it's getting better. So that's good. Work was fine. We had a little excitement today. Microsoft released some updates, apparently, and we had a couple of little different interesting wiggles in that, but that stuff happens. And they rebooted the servers, and everything came back up, and all was copacetic. So, yay. We're puttering along. We're through most of our migration stuff now so that we can actually get back and do real project work, which is good. If you're hearing that little that is the holder for my phone, and it has an infrared sensor on it so that when my hand gets close to it, it opens. And when my hand's on the steering wheel and it's quiet, you're going to hear that go, because it has little wings on it that go in and out, and it looks like it's waving at me. So there you go. It's a very friendly phone holder. So work is good. We're puttering along. Got some good things done this week. That's always good. Got some things resolved this week that had been kind of hanging over our heads for a little while. Made some users happy, so yay. Disappointed some users, well, that happens. But step at a time. So that's good. Costumes are going fine. We did do National Nude Day last weekend, so that was a new costume. It was that full body rhinestone suit with a blinged out cowboy hat that was just covered in rhinestones, and boots that were just covered in rhinestone, and gloves that were mostly covered in rhinestone, so I was very shiny. And people seemed to enjoy that. It is fascinating to me, because as part of the experience that we had, where Lynette was denied her credentialing because of my costumes, as part of that, what Lynette and I discussed coming out of that was that she gets to set the boundaries. So you just tell me what makes you uncomfortable, and I'll figure out a way not to do that, because sometimes the summary that I'm given of what makes her uncomfortable is the more feminine stuff. And my response uniformly is, I don't know what that means. Because I don't know what that means. I grew up in the Philippines, and we had multiple cultures in the Philippines, and each had a different designation of how women should dress to attract the male eye. And there were things that certain cultures, like the Filipinos, saw no big deal with, i.e. cleavage. There were things that the Indian culture saw no big deal with, i.e. midriffs. And there were things that the Chinese saw no big deal with, i.e. slits that went all the way up to their hips. Which gets to be hysterical when you get those cultures together, because the men don't quite know where to look. Because they're used to one of those things, but the other two things are just over the top for them. I've also been in Fiji where the men's wear skirts. I can probably approximate for the United States culture what would be considered feminine and what would be considered masculine. But I know that in the audience that I am going to see at Walmart, that definition is going to vary widely. And I also know that sliding against that standard is a way that I will get into a lot of conversations and I will make a lot of people laugh. Had lots of responses to the rhinestone cowboy outfit. I saw one of my friends there a couple of days later and realized that I hadn't seen her on Friday or Saturday, which was unusual. I said, "Oh, I missed you over the weekend." I said, "We were celebrating National Nude Day." And she went, "What?" And I said, "I didn't go with option A." So then, of course, she laughed like people usually do. I said, "But I went with option B because rhinestone cowboy suits are also known as nudie suits." So I explained that. And then I pulled out my phone and I showed her a picture of it. And she bust into laughter. She just thought it was the greatest thing ever. So do I go with that for a standard? Or do I go with those who are smirking? Or do I go with those who are not enthusiastic? Or those who are scowling? Which standard do I go with? And I've just decided that, you know, I will push it as far as I feel comfortable pushing it, and whatever happens, happens. Well, what was interesting to me in the rhinestone cowboy suit is I had originally gotten a belt to go on the bodysuit to sort of break up the lines a little bit, and potentially I had a kind of a rhinestone tassel skirt to kind of break up the lines a little bit. But I walked out with the belt on and I said, "You know, should I do the belt like this?" And my beloved just said, "Why don't you take the belt off? Let me see what it looks like with the belt off." And she said, "Yeah, I like it better that way. Just don't worry about a belt." So it Friday and Saturday was just a full one-piece bodysuit. And that was fine. People seemed to enjoy it. I didn't have any problem with it, you know. But it wasn't necessarily something that I would judge non-feminine. So where we are right now is I make the presentation and I say, "What do you think?" And then she tells me what she thinks. And it's all just good because I can work with anything. So it is a fascinating endeavor, and it's, you know, finding the art of the possible. So that's been fun. I think on track. I may be 400 words down this week. I just kind of got tired last night and decided I'd wrap it up. But I'm on chapter 22, which I should be right on track. According to all the numbers, that should be good. I have another 4 weeks on this writing sprint, so I am theoretically on Saturday. I should be to 120,000 words. Another 4 weeks technically will take me somewhere around 160,000 words, which is where I usually am. 150. 150 is the target for these books, 150,000 words. So that sets out usually to somewhere around 450 pages, somewhere in there. So all of that's going well. I've hit a lot of the points that I want to hit. Now it's a matter of just sort of wrapping things up a little bit and landing the book. I think I know what's happening for the rest of the book. I have an inkling where the epilogue is, but we'll see. So I think that's all good. This week, I came across an article on cognitive behavioral therapy, from what I have seen of cognitive behavioral therapy, it seems to be effective and seems to be able to help people. The one thing that I have noted is that cognitive behavioral therapy doesn't have any space that I have seen in it for what I would call the flesh and the spirit. Which is fine, because not every theory has to have everything I believe in it. But I've just noted that that isn't there. I came across this article, and they were complimentary in this article about cognitive behavioral therapy as well. But they did make some notes in the article about things that they felt like were not extensive enough in cognitive behavioral therapy. And because to the man with a hammer, all the world is a nail, I took that to mean what they were saying, without actually saying it because they didn't know it, is what they were missing was flesh and spirit. That cognitive behavioral therapy is actually very rational when there is a piece of this that is not rational at all. It's simply dedicated to destruction. And until you understand that, there can be pieces that you're missing. So, anyways, goodness, there's lots of stuff in here. Hold on. I didn't pick up the mail yesterday, so there's been several deliveries here. Okay, and there's that one, and that one, and that one is mine as well. And this one is probably mine as well. Yep. Yeah, so there, lots of stuff came in today. So anyways, the gist of the article is that cognitive behavioral therapy rests on an unlikely idea that we can be rational after all. And so the author was talking about his own experiences with that, and I thought it was an interesting article, and it's had some interesting things to say. So as soon as we get in the garage here, I'll just read you a few clips and do a little commentary. And then I do need to figure out if last week I mentioned the YouTube video that I had watched on staying calm. That was really good. So, Peter Attia was talking about that, and that really was very, very good. I think I mentioned that last week. But I'll just look up real quick while we're chatting, and there is a sad disadvantage with backing into my garage this time of day, because there's enough glare, the sun is low enough on the horizon that it comes in through my window, because our house faces like southwest when you're looking out from the garage. And with it facing southwest, the glare comes in the window, reflects off the seats, and then reflects onto the display for my little Android unit, and I can't see. But we got that done. Moving on. So, we'll just go over some of this stuff quickly. The author talks about the fact that they've only had one panic attack. Said it happened during the fall of 2008, during a period when my wife and I were graduate students in English. I was walking across the sunny quad wearing a casual tweed jacket, thinking about all the papers I had to grade, when suddenly a wave of fear washed over me. Its origin wasn't all that mysterious. I had no workable plan for my life. There were almost no jobs for new English professors, and the search for work would likely send me and my wife to different parts of the country. How could we ever build a life together or start a family? Intellectually, I had known for years that we were approaching our future in an unrealistic way, but now the problem registered as a physical assault, contained in the brightness of the sun and the stirring of the air. Oh my God, I thought, what am I going to do? Breathing hard, I paced up and down the path, preparing to throw up. It took a few moments for these sensations to pass. Eventually, the sound of the chapel bell steadied me, and I sat on a bench, drained and disturbed. He said that one thing that dismayed me about the panic attack was its accuracy. My life really did need a major course correction, which I had no idea how to affect. But I was also unsettled by what the attack said about my personality. Having grown up in a tumultuous family with a mother beset by alcoholism, I had worked hard to master my feelings through homegrown strategies of self-regulation. I had at various times felt guilty, angry, paralyzed, worthless, incompetent, or ashamed in ways that I knew made no sense, and over the years, I figured out how to stop or at least attenuate those feelings. In many respects, overcoming my childhood was the story of my life. I took pride in not being messed up. So he does talk he talked to someone about the panic attack, and they mentioned cognitive behavioral therapy, a rational kind of therapy, she explained, that focused on influencing your emotions by inspecting and adjusting your thought patterns. So CBT has exercises that you do. And to quote someone named Burns, your thoughts often have much more to do with how you feel than what's actually happening in your life. Now, that's an interesting side point. Your thoughts have more to do with how you feel than what's actually happening in your life. That is true. I have seen this manifested over and over in the individuals that I have had the pleasure to become friends with. If you will listen to them talk, they will tell you all the terrible and horrible things that are ahead. But if you look at their life, in fact, there has been a progression upward, and there's every reason to believe that progression upward will continue. But they don't see it that way. And that is the time when I then begin to try to frame for them these feelings that you're having are actually based on lies that your flesh is telling you. So when you have this feeling, what you should do is try to figure out what lie the flesh is telling you at that point. And once you expose that lie, often what you can do is mitigate that feeling. So the author says they were skeptical about cognitive behavioral therapy. They'd read The Interpretation of Dreams and Civilizations and Its Discontents and doubted our irrational moods and feelings could be brought under control with such rational control. But when I got to Burns's list of cognitive distortions, bad mental habits that cause us to react inappropriately, I started to change my view. I recognized myself vividly in the list. And the author says, I've been particularly fond of personalization, the tendency to assume responsibility for a negative event when there is no basis for doing so. Now, in all of this discussion, the author is going to say, I am the one that's doing this. And in a technical sense, that's true. He is the one who's doing this, but it is a part of him that hates him. And if you don't get that straight, then you feel like you're doing something to yourself and you can't figure out why you can't just stop doing that to yourself. So they try to explain it away. On some level, personalization had been the reigning condition of my teenage years. Yes, because that's where the flesh attacks us. Emerging from a disorganized and confusing childhood, I had imagined that I had created it. So he adopted certain strategies. Said a key effort involved a kind of internal mental effort that seemed vaguely telepathic, like something out of the sci-fi novel Dune. I just control my feelings, holding them very carefully as though I were walking around the house while carrying a bowl brimming with water. When I sense a bad feeling unbalancing me, anxiety, stress, guilt, I'd wrinkle my brow and hold my mind steady, pushing the bad feeling away with the kind of brain work that registered as physical. And on top of all this, I was constantly thinking about my life, trying to decide whether, in an almost philosophical way, whether I was a decent person. So one of the cognitive behavioral therapy ways of dealing with this is the double column technique, where you put a line down the middle of a sheet of paper, and then you start recording your automatic thoughts, your fears, your dissatisfactions, your grumblings, your confections on the left, and your rational responses to those on the right. Faced with an unreasonably angry patient who calls him incompetent and money-grubbing, Burns' automatic thought is he should at least respect me, but his rational response resists all-or-nothing thinking. He asks himself, do you expect him to show respect all the time or part of the time? In fact, the man is sometimes respectful. If you don't expect perfection, you won't feel frustrated, Barnes says. So, you know, and these are good techniques. These are good techniques, and they can help. But there is an underlying problem that they talk about of these techniques. And I thought, yep, that's true. So the idea, and so they were talking about one psychiatrist, I think he's a psychiatrist, that kind of started off his stuff, well, I'm going to say two words to you right now, and I want you to take them out of my office and with you and incorporate them into your life. Are you ready? Yes, Collins says. Stop it! Newhart screams. Which, you know, if you hear him screaming at you, stop it, every time you're having bad thoughts, that might help. But the article goes on to say, the idea that we can challenge and adjust our automatic thoughts makes us feel like we're in control. Brewer went on, but constantly wrestling with our thinking can itself become a bad mental habit. If you feel anxious, the best approach might not be to interrogate your anxious feelings or mount a rational counterattack, but simply to notice the anxiety and let it pass. Okay, this is actually similar to what I've suggested to people. Brewer goes on to say, it'll go away on its own. If you push it away or engage with it or tussle with it, it will grow. So here's the difference. If you feel anxious about something, you know, you can tell yourself, well, you shouldn't be feeling anxious. What's wrong with you? Why are you feeling anxious about that? You know, just stop it. Stop feeling anxious about this, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That focuses you on the anxiety. And if you focus on the anxiety will simply grow. You don't, in my mind, want to focus on the anxiety because then you get into a shouting match with the flesh over what the flesh is trying to convince you of without actually realizing what the flesh is making you anxious about. And so it's this tussle. Now, if you can stop, if you can back up and say, what really am I concerned about here? Oh, I'm concerned that because this thing isn't working, I might lose my job. Okay, and my flesh is telling me, well, you screw up this one time and they're going to fire you. Well, once you get that out in the open and you kind of look at it, you go, no, I don't think that's true. And then once you realize it isn't true, it's amazing how quickly that stuff goes away. The psychologist... In a book called Unwinding Anxiety from 2021, said, with mindfulness, it's about changing the relationship to cognition. The thought is already there. It's not something we have a lot of control over. It's going to come up, but you can observe it, and by observing it, you can change your relationship to it. And that's true, but I like to go just a little farther than that and say you can observe the thought, and then you can ask yourself, why in the world would I think that? Why, what catastrophe am I concerned about? What steps do I imagine that will happen that will lead to this catastrophe? Are those steps legitimate? And so there's a way that you can kind of back up from the catastrophizing to figure out if that actually made much sense. So this is interesting. The psychologist walked the author through a hypothetical cognitive behavioral therapy for a patient. For example, we might have a client recall in detail one specific event that she really remembers well. We work through that first on an intellectual level. So maybe it's abuse or trauma that happened in their past. But then we might ask the client to visualize it as though it's happening right now. She's a 7-year-old child coming home from school, and the mother hits and hits her for waking her up when she comes in, even though the child didn't do anything wrong. All she did was come home. And then we can kind of do cognitive behavioral therapy with the 7-year-old child. We can ask, what is the child feeling? What is she thinking? And we can ask the client, do you believe that thought a little bit or a medium or amount? And then we might have the child continue the image until she's in a safe place, maybe tucked into bed. And then we might ask the client to have her older self come into that room too. And when the younger one says, "Mommy hit me because I'm bad," the older one answers her back. And so woven into this is this idea that you've had this experience, you've formed a certain thought pattern over this experience that is actually built on lies. Then your older self can help you see that it's built on lies and help you understand that that structure is not true, that it wasn't your fault that you got hit when you got home because you woke your mother up even though you were supposed to be coming home. So he concludes the articles by saying that CBD does contain a theory of change and it's not entirely convincing. If people could change just because rational thinking told them to, we wouldn't live in such a crazy world. Yet the rationality of CBT is aspirational. We can wish that we were the kinds of people who could solve our biggest problems simply by seeing them more clearly. Sometimes by acting as though we are those people, we can become them. But the mind is an alien place. It's impossible to describe anyone completely and accurately. That only makes it more powerful when a therapeutic model offers you a way of describing yourself to yourself. So, do we have core beliefs? Are we really shaped by our automatic thoughts? Simply by proposing such ideas, we can make them almost true. It's by believing in descriptions that we allow our therapy to slide from theory into practice. Scaling the rock face of our own problems, we can carve out the rock in fresh ways, inventing handholds. We can create new routes where none existed. In the years leading up to my panic attack, I wanted to be the sort of person who dealt with his problems through roundabout artistic means. I didn't particularly want to be a rational person. CBT helped me notice this and ask why not. Okay, so all that's good. All that's good. But I think it's also an extremely powerful tool to imagine and image the fact that there is a destroyer within us that is seeking to take the elements of our lives and lie about them in order to cause us distress because it hates us. That puts a really interesting twist on things. If you understand that your flesh hates you, then you get a chance to decide, am I going to listen to this? Am I going to take advice from someone who hates me? Or am I going to evaluate whatever thoughts that thing is trying to communicate to me and say, is that true? I don't think that's true. Because in the process then of evaluating that, if you can see that it's a lie, then you can say to yourself, in other words, you're just telling me that lie. Sorry, I'm packing up my stuff here. You're just telling me that lie because you're trying to damage me. It's not that it's true. It's just hurtful. And if I allow you to tell me something that's hurtful, it will hurt me. So I have a choice. Once I recognize that that is not true, I have a choice as to whether or not I want to listen to that. Instead of saying out loud, if necessary, I don't believe that that's true. I don't believe I deserve to be punished in that way because of XYZ. I think what is true is that I was a small child and I was coming home like I was supposed to do, and I was coming into the house and I did my best to be quiet, but I woke you up anyways. Because I think when we can identify the lies that the flesh tells us are usually egregious enough, and they're ridiculous enough, that often as soon as you hear yourself saying them, you stop and say, yeah, I don't think that's true. And then you can go from there. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.